In the opening verses of John's Gospel, it is written, "The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it." In a world in which so many voices and conversations offer a great deal of heat, but little light, your friends at 1517.org invite you to explore its podcasting network of 20 different shows. Do you have an interest in Christian history? Then Christian History Almanac will surely interest you. This five-minute podcast consists of stories from the past about men and women, saints and sinners all, who helped shape the great tradition of Christianity. The show is brief, always concludes with a moving piece of prose or poetry, and most importantly, a reminder that everything is going to be okay. Are you looking for meaty conversations on theology, the movers and shakers of church history, and Christian apologetics? If so, check out the original show, The Thinking Fellows, going on 7 years now. The fellows are sure to hold your interest. Perhaps you are looking for smart and engaging studies of the Bible. Then check out 30 Minutes in the New Testament or 40 Minutes in the Old Testament or both. These and a host of other 1517 podcasts are all available across every major podcasting platform, as well as at 1517.org. That's 1517.org. In each and every case, you will receive not only engaging talk, but most importantly, you will receive Christ Jesus, the crucified and risen Savior, Christ Jesus, the light of the world.
Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the November 22nd edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. That's episode 200 for anybody keeping count. I'm Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here. He's an author, a political commentator, and the founder of the eponymous investment firm, The Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Hello, Will.
Good to see you back in California. It's been too long. Although I did see you last week in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
You did. Isn't Grand Rapids a beautiful little town?
It's like a tiny Chicago. I really like it.
It's just quaint.
Yes.
And the DeVosses have a lot to do with that.
Their name is placard. I'm just going to make that word up. All over the place. And they seem to have done an awful lot to help the city along. And so has Father Sirico of the Acton Institute. And are we under a gag order? I don't even know.
No.
Once you come out of the thing.
First of all, I'm not going to lie. I'm not under a gag order of anything ever. But certainly not on the good work of our friends at Acton. So what are you wondering if you're gagged about?
Well, the ostensible purpose of being there was to celebrate a kind of retirement, but not really, of Father Robert Sirico, who founded the organization. And you honored me by allowing me to sit at your table with Father Sirico and a bunch of other really wonderful people. But in the 19, you read about the 19th century where you had the Lincoln-Douglas debates and people could talk for hours and thousands of people would stand around for hours and listen. And I would always wonder, like, who has the attention span? Like, are they so deprived of actual entertainment that they'll stand around and listen to a lecture? And then Father Sirico went on for, I don't know, maybe an hour max, 45 minutes, an hour. And I could have gone for two or three more hours. It was so smart and seemed so improvisational, but just really brilliant and deep. He talked, of course, as he always does, about putting the human flourishing at the center of any question about economics. And what do we know about human flourishing? Well, we have to study, you know, first of all, what the human is and how it is built. And how is it built? It is built as a co-creator. We are built as co-creators with God. And so I can't even do him justice. But I was just so entranced and hooping and a-hollering as he went on. It was just it was awesome. Thank you.
Well, he is a force of nature. That guy is as compelling a speaker as I've ever heard. And it's true that I'm enthralled by the content and the message, and I consider it to be the animating force of my life, and I have for a long time. But he has a lot to do with that, and I don't just mean his convictions and the principles behind it, which have become my principles, my mission, and my purpose. His delivery of it, his pastoral nature, his genuine care about poverty. In a lot of ways, I view, and it's interesting because I was teasing the two of you at dinner that I was surrounded by a former Marxist on my right and a former Marxist on my left, and you were kind of literally a Marxist, and he was sort of a fake Marxist. Like, what that meant was he was in this intellectual circle that was sort of bumping elbows with like Jane Fonda and these people. Mm-hmm. Like, you kind of had a mm-hmm. cosmopolitan late 60s progressive sort of thing going on. But he, I don't think he ever identified as a card-carrying Marxist, where you had the membership card, right?
Well,
right.
There were no cards, but you got the idea, yeah.
You got the idea.
Part of the CPUSA, that LA, whole thing. LA group.
I think that there was a heart that attracted you to that school of thought, and there was a heart that attracted him to it, and then there was a heart and a mind that pulled both of you out. And I want all of us who are defenders of the free enterprise system to have that heart. I hate that line of, well, you want the heart of a socialist but the mind of a capitalist. Mm. You know, I don't believe that collective ownership of property reflects a good-heartedness. I don't believe that command and control of the economy, but I also don't think that like scaling it back and taking the rough edges of controlling the means of production and just sort of going to a kind of a benign central planner's paradise reflects a great heart either. I think it's dehumanizing. I think it's wildly inefficient. But I think that the heart of our system is not inferior to their system, and we just make up for it with our brain. Mm. I think that the Father Sirico stands for a declaration that the true heart for the poor, the heart for the human person, the belief in a never-ending fight for dignity of the human person is indeed the one embedded in our worldview.
Well, let me ask you if this makes sense to you. Like, I was flying home and I was thinking, you know, how do I encapsulate this for my friends and family? You know, what I discover every time I hang around the Acton Institute. And it's the idea that we really are all created in just remarkably unique ways, no two humans alike. And the result of that is that we have different talents and different qualities. And this requires us, therefore, to lean on others. We are driven to community by that fact, I think. I'm not really a mechanically inclined guy. Therefore, if I hope to have anything mechanically done around me, I better have, you know, some relationship with somebody.
Somebody like me who's really works with his hands a lot, who's kind of known for his mechanical prowess.
Right, exactly.
Blue collar, bona fides.
100%. So, you know, this goes on and on myriad different ways. You know, I'm also not a chemist, also not a biologist, also not a basketball player. We are driven by our gifts, and I won't even call them deficiencies, by the unique constellation of our own gifts into the arms of other people. And if not literally into their arms, then into relationship with them. And that the free market is not an end goal. It's simply the, what do you say, the blooming of that natural instinct for community that we have. And anything that tends to try to, I think, destroy that market, that tries to limit it, is really in some ways, I think, interfering with the freedom to act out our own salvation in relationship with other people.
Well, to act out our dreams and to define those dreams, and then I agree with you, the diversity of how God made the world is not a point that belongs to others to share. It's our point, because we hold to a certain creation theology, a belief about God, the anthropology of God and man, that is, it's inherent in this creation that we are diverse and that we are created with different, you know, to use the mechanic skill, different talents, different interests, different skill levels. And so I find it incredibly ironic and sometimes maddening that we have this obsession with diversity right now, except for no one actually cares about the only diversity that really matters.
Right.
The diversity of skills and dreams and hopes and abilities, there is an incredibly opportunistic pool in the free enterprise, in the free and virtuous society, for people to be heavily diverse, play off of each other's skills, see a wildly diverse labor pool and everyone to flourish within those realities and to achieve certain degrees of specialization never thought possible. So one of the interesting things in me teaching this econ class I've been teaching at Pacifica, that you had a kind of early understanding, a division of labor, really almost like with Plato and certainly with Aristotle. And then you see the way Adam Smith expanded upon it a couple thousand years later, and you see the way we talk about division of labor now. The biggest difference was not that all of a sudden we really understood what it means that one person could specialize in X while another was in Y and they could both benefit from it. Plato pretty much got that. The thing that Plato and Aristotle didn't get, because it didn't exist at the time, was that one guy could do X for 10 years and do Y another 10 years. That there was a dynamic mobility. It did not exist. If you were a farmer, you were a farmer. If you were a machine worker with Adam Smith in the early days, you know, whatever, there you were in a lane.
Yeah.
And now we get to not only have the beauty of division of labor, but we get to have it with a lot of dynamism.
And on the left, that scene is a curse, you know, as if you should just stick to, you know, 40 years at the plow. I remember reading Richard Hofstadter when I was a little Marxist, the famous political scientist who wrote The Age of Reform. And, of course, one of his major concepts is status anxiety, the fact that he believed that if your status was fixed, as it was in sort of the pre-modern world, a farmer is going to be a farmer and a priest is going to be a priest, then you're not anxious because you always know where you're going to go, as if this was somehow some sort of benefit. Now, maybe I'm speaking as a cultural, you know, I'm clearly an American who grew up in a, you know, post-modern or modern and post-modern, post-industrial even world. But my own sense is that for a lot of Americans, the idea that you're stuck would be anathema. It would be anti-American. The idea that you are supposed to be exactly and only where you are and not dream, not aspire higher, that would shock people, I think, in this country. But that is exactly how legislation comes down and regulation comes down out of Sacramento, out of D.C., out of our local city halls. The idea that, well, you know, you're an Uber driver now, you should be an Uber driver for the rest of your life, and let's build a lifestyle around being an Uber driver that includes full benefits and healthcare, et cetera. Or your, you know, Lorena Gonzalez's sectoral bargaining effort. You are a McDonald's worker. That's all you'll ever be. And so we better plan for a society in which all McDonald's workers are always going to be McDonald's workers.
Yeah.
And therefore, we have to come in and rescue them from the idiocy of this work and the impoverishment of this culture.
I talked to you about the analogy that, now let's see, was this Hayek? Yeah, this was Hayek that he used. Gosh, I hope. Well, hold on. Give me a second. Was it Milton Friedman? About the handicapped man.
Yeah, it's sounding familiar already.
That Go. When if we see somebody in a wheelchair, and we go, what's the situation here? And they go, oh, he'd hurt his leg, but he's on the mend. Doctors say he'll be out by tomorrow, maybe a couple more days, but he's just needed the wheelchair to kind of help rest. But he's good, fine. He's pretty much recovered, and he'll be back walking in a couple of days. And would someone go, oh, what a tragedy to see a handicapped person? We would go, oh, well, that he's in a wheelchair right now, but he's not handicapped because he's on the mend. He'll be back up, walking. Maybe he's on crutches for a few days, mm-hmm. and then he'll be running around. He's retraining to get back out in cross country or track and field in another few weeks. So it would make no sense to refer to that person in his stationary lot in life. You know what? I think this was actually Thomas Sowell.
Hmm.
But forgive me, because they're all the options are masters. So, but I hate attributing it wrongly. But I think the analogy is brilliant. In a free enterprise system, no one ever needs to be referred to in the handicap context because it's always temporal. They may not get out of that situation, but they always have the potential. Where handicap refers to someone who's stuck, unable to walk, they're paraplegic, they have a tragedy in their life, right? And I think that we to take the physical metaphor and apply it into the economic context, I think there's a lot of power in that analogy, that somebody does not get referred to with permanence when you're describing a condition that you know to be temporary. Nobody would expect that, but we do it economically all the time. And so that's the whole problem with class ideology, class struggle, when people talk about income inequality. They say, well, the lowest paid people are this much apart from the highest paid people, and they never mention that they're not the same people.
Right, right.
That high paid people drop and lower paid people go up. So there's this constant, like, getting in and out of wheelchairs, so to speak, tomorrow. Yeah. And what our producer's telling me, I was right, it is Thomas Sowell. And so I think that that's the analogy I'd look at. But it's not just an economic point. It's certainly not just a semantics point. It speaks to the whole view of the human person. The anthropology of free enterprise allows for this belief that no one is ever a slave to the conditions they were born in. Or even necessarily to bad decisions they make, because I'm very big on individual responsibility, on agency, and bad decisions people make can hold them back, no question. But they don't necessarily do that forever.
No. There's so much more we could talk about. The fact that he took on, as he called them, I think, our friends on the right or something like that. He really went after, you know, the Randians for their, you know, materialist perspective on markets. That they fail to understand that human flourishing is the, you know, the purpose of these markets, and that they ought to be God-centered. He, you know, talked about, it was wonderful to hear him talk about people on the right who have become authoritarians. And, you know, he explicitly called out a few organizations in private conversation that he worries about. People who think, as he put it, I think, in his speech, he said something like, you know, we don't need new people in the Politburo. We need no Politburos. You know, so there's this authoritarianism of the left and right that we have to be wary of these days. There's so much to get to, and I've already, like, trimmed a whole bunch of stuff from the run list that I sent you, so you'll pardon me if I skip through things rather quickly. But I wanted to start with Kamala and Gavin and the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict. Of course, you know, you'd have to be absolutely inattentive to what's going on in the world if you missed the fact that Kyle Rittenhouse, the then 17, now 18-year-old kid with the rifle in Kenosha, was let off on all counts, found, you know, not guilty. And, of course, predictably—
Which really denied a legal press novelty, where for the first time in history, we would have been able to convict a white supremacist for killing white people.
Yeah, there you go. And yet this was exactly the message, that this is clear evidence of white supremacy. And, of course, his, you know, the two people he killed were
both
white.
I'm not giving up on the theory. I still think there's something to do a white supremacist killing white people.
It's a little bit like, oh my gosh, I'm totally blanking, Dave Chappelle's Black White Racist. Remember the skit?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
You know, Gavin Newsom tweets out immediately. I think I sent that to you. That you know,
I didn't get a Newsom tweet on it.
Oh,
I
you
got,
didn't? Here
I
you
got
go.
The president.
Let me pass it to you.
Here's... Did you see what Biden tweeted?
No. What did he say?
He tweeted like we have to respect the jury system, and then everyone got mad at him, and he had to walk it back.
What did he say? Like I was getting a colonoscopy.
He's like,
at the time.
I got to say, I've been thinking about it. I'm pretty upset about this.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Where do you break the law? Carrying weapons built for a military, shoot and kill people, and get away with it. That's the message we sent to armed vigilantes.
You should read that more forcefully, I think, so that people at the other end of this.
I'm sorry. Gavin Newsom, America Today, you can break the law, carry around weapons built for a military, shoot and kill people and get away with it. That's the message we've just sent to armed vigilantes across the nation.
Yes.
Okay, well, first of all, I'd like to say something, because I do not believe Kyle Rittenhouse was blameless.
No, I'm with you.
The reason that he got away with it is because they didn't charge him with what he did. All they had to do was charge him with reckless endangerment, and he would have been convicted. So Gavin Newsom is here saying something totally outside of the reality of the moment. The prosecutors chose to charge first-degree murder when they knew damn well it wasn't murder, period. Now, for people who look at the situation and go, yeah, I don't— Look, at the time he pulled the trigger, there was someone attacking him. It was defense. There is plausible, you know, an acceptable legal case for self-defense. You can't convict him of murder, but it sure seems like he shouldn't have gone down there with a gun and it was begging for trouble. They are the ones who chose not to charge him with that. So don't give me this. Go for a lesser charge if you want a conviction. In this case, they would have got it. Maybe I'm wrong, but that I'm quite confident that there was a legal justification to say there was some reckless endangerment. He would have done probation. He probably would have been charged as a juvenile. But and so, yeah, it wouldn't have been good enough for these people. but it would have been the right legal way to go.
Right. Well, he wasn't the only guy there with a gun, of course. The third person he shot through
the
bicep.
The people that were shooting at him?
Yeah. So, and then, you know, it's now emerged, of course, through this trial that a lot of the people who were in Kenosha that night had traveled across state borders in order to create, you know, acts of mayhem in the streets. That's part of what this kid wandered into.
By the way, how many miles did he go across state border?
Not a lot. I don't remember the exact number, but
like 15, 13?
It's really short.
I think this cross-state line thing is a little bit dishonest.
It's
like saying like he's in Blythe, Arizona, and they're like, he crossed state line. You mean from Burger King to KFC?
Yeah, exactly, across the street. Then there's Kamala Harris. You can always count on Kamala. The verdict, she tweets out, the verdict really speaks for itself. That's a non-statement. I accept that. The verdict spoke for itself. It was that he was not guilty. She continues, however, as many of you know, I spent a majority of my career working to make the justice system more equitable, and clearly there is a lot more work to do. The irony of this statement, a woman who was abandoned during her primary run for president by progressives, was precisely because she did not try during her career to make the justice system more equitable. She is infamous here in California for having locked up people who did not commit crimes, including black people, for minor possession of weed, a crime to which she later admitted she herself was guilty multiple times when she, you know, was trying to establish her street cred with the left. She said, yeah, I used to smoke.
It was a crime, though.
Pardon?
Wasn't that a crime?
Yes. It was absolutely a crime.
Oh, I thought you said that she locked people up who didn't commit a crime.
I'm sorry. She locked people up who did not commit crimes. She also locked up people who committed very minor crimes.
Weed possession. Maybe things that shouldn't have been crimes.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
Things to which she later admitted she herself was guilty.
But what were the things that she locked people up for that weren't crimes?
Well, there were ample cases, and I'll have to go back. We actually talked about this on an earlier episode during the primary, but the cases that I recall were those in which people were convicted of murder and did not, or at least there was ample evidence they had not committed those crimes, and she refused to get those people off death row. Refused to open up their cases again for reexamination. These are sort of those Innocence Project cases. A number of these cases in California. And she was, you know, licking her index finger and sticking it in the wind and trying to figure out, how will the political winds blow if I let a guy off death row? This will be my Michael Dukakis moment. I let a murderer go. So she just kept her mouth shut and let people simmer in hell, you know, hell on earth. She is reviled on the left, the far left, because she failed really to carry out justice in her role as a DA. I'm sorry, as the Attorney General. We could go on, but that's flogging the Kamala horse. So everybody's got an opinion on this, I guess. You and I are in heated agreement. Kyle Rittenhouse shouldn't have been there. You don't walk around with high-powered rifles in a volatile situation. Let the police do their thing, man.
And now I do hope that, we don't want to make a martyr of him and make him give him his own talk show, you know, next week on Newsmax or something. I mean, it's time for him to heal a bit, recover, be with his family. Kind of, there's some things that are off there that need to get, you know, rectified. And unfortunately, I think he'll be used as a prop by the right in a similar way to how the left has tried to use him as a prop. Mm-hmm. I hope I'm wrong, but I can see it happening. And so I'm concerned there. But either way, we got to move on, and I do think it's better to move on without this young man being in prison.
Yeah, let's do a couple of updates. We've talked before, this switching the subject here, to Merrick Garland's infamous October 3rd or 4th, I think it was October the 4th memo.
This guy turned into the biggest jackass in the world, or what?
It is so shocking. I can remember when what's-his-bucket, Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell refused Obama's recommendation that the Senate confirm Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court because McConnell said, you know, look, man, it's too close to an election. And one could agree or disagree with McConnell at that point. But it was his prerogative to do what he did. Thank God he did what he did. And I don't think he was doing it necessarily on the merits or knowing that this is how this guy would turn out. But just to refresh the memories of those who are listening, Merrick Garland, we now know, here's the order of the conspiracy, worked with the National School Board Association, one of whose biggest members is the California School Board Association. This is a very liberal teacher union controlled organization that operates as
you
if
said
it,
very liberal union organization.
I'm sorry, that's redundant. So Garland works with the NSBA, the National School Boards Association, and writes a memo, has them write a letter to him saying, oh my God, help us, we're under assault. Our school board members and teachers are being attacked by violent white supremacists who are upset with us, and they're clearly like Trumpies. And Garland issues a memo to the FBI and says, investigate these domestic terrorist parents. And the evidence now is piling up that he is a disaster in the DOJ office. Yeah. He is just a bad person, bad political instincts, bad worldview, a corrupt individual. Andy McCarthy doesn't...
kind of arrogant.
Super arrogant. Yeah. Yeah. This is a guy who just, you know, will not back down, just says,
but I
no,
thought
I'm
the
right.
play was, this was the nicest guy who was... Yeah. Barely even a centrist, like borderline, just moderate, like an Anthony Kennedy that Obama had appointed to the high court that Mitch McConnell just screwed over.
Yeah.
He seems to me to be, obviously, there's a lot of bitterness and a lot of incoherence in his worldview, and he's behaving irrationally. And this is, he's setting himself up to make Eric Holder look like a better attorney general.
Yeah.
Now think about what I just said.
I heard it. I heard it, brother. Yeah, there is no chance that the NFL is going to hire this guy as they did Eric Holder. Yeah, so I'll put in the show notes a great piece, November 20th, by Andy McCarthy called Did Merrick Garland Commit Perjury? The title is... Not important, because ultimately Andy concludes, no, Merrick Garland didn't commit perjury. It's a small issue. It's complexity without the value of being all that entertaining. But Andy is brilliant in laying out what this story is really about. And, of course, what he says it's really about is that you've got an attorney general who simply, like all Democrats before him in the White House, is prepared to use the power of his law enforcement agency to go pester people with whom he disagrees by calling them racists and white supremacists. That's this whole initiative here in a nutshell. But I just think it's important to note that here in California, the California School Boards Association filed a letter that is remarkably eerily similar to the NSBA note. And they sent that to Rob Bonta, the attorney general of California, who is so closely affixed to the nether regions of the California Teachers Association and the teachers unions in general, that it would be unseemly for me to continue the metaphor. Mm. You get the picture.
I do.
And they sent the same letter to Gavin Newsom and said, you know, like, my dear God, we are under assault. And they have zero evidence that there is really anything here for the feds to do. And maybe the silence. We at California Policy Center submitted a Public Records Act request to the attorney general and to the governor. We heard immediately from the AG, oh, we have nothing to report on this. There were no internal conversations. We're pursuing our own inquiry with that, mind you. But the governor's office, Newsom's office, has not said anything. The clock is ticking. They're up on their time extension here under the law to get back to us with an acknowledgement here in a couple of days, and I'll let you know how that goes. But this is how they work on the teachers union side. They basically get their allies elected, and then they appeal to them to come and run political interference for them all over the place. And this is just one of those examples. We talked about the Getty wedding and the fact that our buddy Gavin Newsom could not be bothered to attend the Glasgow climate conference, wasn't willing to explain why that was, later came out and said, it was because my kids wanted me to stay home and go trick-or-treating. And then he appeared in a magnificent, salacious, weird kind of Hunger Games sort of Vogue story that you first sent to me, just to, again, tip my hat to you for finding this story through Politico, you said, I think.
Uh-huh.
But the Vogue story got the attention of a lot of lefties who, for reasons of inequality and social justice are just appalled. They didn't see the irony in going to celebrate an oil baroness's wedding while skipping out on a climate conference. They went right to the nub of the thing here, which is that this kind of wealth is disgusting. I'll put a story in the show notes here. It was one of the best I found in terms of just sort of revealing everything, every way in which the left views supreme wealth, like the Getty wealth. But the headline says it all. It's on a little website called The Bold Italic, which describes itself as an online magazine that celebrates the character and freewheeling spirit of San Francisco and the Bay Area. Freewheeling. Not so freewheeling that they allow rich people to do crazy, you know, to go be crazy and do things that the Baroness of Getty would do here, this young woman. But the headline is Ivy Getty's San Francisco Wedding is Why We Need a Wealth Tax. David, we'll come to how you rate wealth taxes here in a second. But the arguments are that psychologically, this kind of wealth injures others who are not well off. We look at somebody like this, and I include myself in this number. We look at people like this, and we go, I deserve some of that money. She doesn't need it all. It's also just practical because, gosh, if we had a wealth tax, then we would not only be protecting the poor and the working class from the humiliation of being poor and working class, but practically we could take this money from a wealth tax and spread it around to poor people and make housing happen and improve education and healthcare. It would be amazing. The most interesting part is the guy kind of makes a spiritual argument that the sudden, unearned, and ostensibly happenstance admission into wealth, I believe, he writes, can have a particularly malignant consequence on the human soul. So inherited wealth is bad for the human soul, he says, and therefore, you know, you initiate a wealth tax, and you're really helping save someone's soul. David, talk to me.
There's a writer, I don't want to say his name, because I actually kind of think the guy's a jackass now, but he wrote this fantastic book a long time ago, and he was talking about this whole thing that Western, urban progressives will do, where they just talk about how awful it is to have money, and they'll be like, look, it's not good to inherit money. It's not good to have this, you know, the decadence of Western prosperity and the blood money of oil, you know, and he said you need to get the poorest villagers you can from India and Bangladesh and give them a few months of Western comforts and life and prosperity that spring from the free market tree, you know, and then tell them, like, this is awful, right? and have them look at you and just get a picture of their face.
Oh, that's
because they will be so pokered, like so mystified by what you're talking about. And this gentleman was an Indian immigrant who came from poverty and became successful in the country. But his point is obviously accurate, that the only people that get away with saying how bad it is to have money are people that have money.
Yes.
Okay? So just shut up with this.
Or it's people
I'll tell you what's dehumanizing. Yeah. It's dehumanizing to have money taken from someone who is going to inherit it, and that person did not work to earn it, and you're going to give it to someone else who also is not going to work to earn it.
That's right.
That's dehumanizing.
That's dehumanizing. Yeah, I'm completely with you there. And with constantly the idea available here on this podcast, and which all of our listeners are well aware because they're all such smart people, I have not yet seen the government program in California that has lifted huge numbers of people out of poverty. I have watched, indeed, over my expansive now lifetime, just watched public education get worse and worse, despite the fact that the money is going up and up. Do not believe the teachers' unions. They'll tell you they're just struggling for cash. Fact is, they're not. And I'm not talking about individual teachers. I'm talking about the money we dump into this government program that does not deliver the results for poor people that it claims it can, if it just has a little more money. You know, one of the things that I really wanted to talk about this week was the tremendous number of fentanyl deaths. And I just want to go over this real quickly, not because we haven't discussed it before. We have. We've talked about Michael Schellenberger's pieces in which he is really documenting the fact that in San Francisco, you know, it's fentanyl, it's drugs, it's open air drug markets, it's quote unquote harm reduction policies that are really allowing open air drug markets and rampant drug use to flourish. the opposite of human flourishing. And the fact that we've got Javier Becerra now running Biden's Health and Human Services agency, who is going to lift exactly the practices that failed in San Francisco and make them policy throughout these United States. It's shocking. We talked about Becerra last episode. So if you don't recall the whole conversation, go back there. But Schellenberger's got a new piece in which he just says, hey, look, we got to arrest drug addicts. And he wants to arrest them so that they can be, you know, either forced into jail or into, you know, some sort of recovery program of some kind. And I was intrigued because this coincided with a conversation you had on the Capitol Record with Amity Schles. Mm-hmm. One piece of which was this, I don't know, 5 or 10 minute conversation you guys had about the rise during Prohibition of alcoholism and the fact that there was this, you know, at that point, experimental little program breaking out in church basements and people's living rooms called Alcoholics Anonymous that was the opposite of a government program. So whether we arrest people or drive them into government-funded recovery programs or do harm reduction programs, as Javier wants us to do throughout the United States or as San Francisco's, you know, vainly rolled out in their county, David, let's talk for a moment about the conversation you had with Amity on how this other model could work and why isn't it more widespread? What are the upsides and downsides? So talk about
A lot of my point with Amity was just the broader point about when we look to some of the programs of the 1930s, you were never going to hear anyone bring up Alcoholics Anonymous as an economic contributor or a cultural dynamic, when in reality, because their agenda is to focus on the ditches that we dug up so they could get filled in, and they thought there was a lot of this great merit out of a lot of government waste, mm-hmm. and they called it the New Deal. A lot of these projects were. Historically remembered as wasteful and stupid. Some of the projects are you know, more noteworthy. I can grant that. But economically, there were a lot of cultural things at play that were going on that Amity and I spoke about, and it's all memorialized in her masterpiece book, The Forgotten Man. But I think that Alcoholics Anonymous, it would be dishonest to claim that it was the major economic event of the 1930s. I only bring it up marginally as an example of something that had no government central planning behind it and was most certainly responding to something that was an economic crisis. Prohibition did not work. Prohibition created a black market for alcohol. It created a significant amount of criminality, violence, underground trade activity. What worked to deal with some of the excesses that were taking place in the culture, coming out of World War I, coming out of economic hardship of going into Great Depression, was the alcoholic helping the alcoholic. And it was faith-based in the way this Oxford group out of Ohio mm-hmm. had mixed up with a group and the famous people that you hear in pop culture referred to as Bill W. and Dr. Bob. Bill W.'s name was Bill Wilson. He didn't die until the 1970s. Mm-hmm. Time magazine ended up covering him, but they didn't really become kind of famous in the culture until John Rockefeller ended up supporting him quite heavily. And all of a sudden there started being profiles in Time magazine and Life magazine.
Yeah, the Cleveland Plain Dealer story is the one that apparently launched it into kind of national fame.
A little bit of profile.
Mm-hmm.
And so, look, there's plenty of things people could say about what treatment programs are best and are not best, but the one thing I will say is give me 10 government programs and give me 10 non-government programs, and I don't need to know any other facts and evidence. I'll just take the 10 non-government programs
right.
because there is something more organic and spontaneous, and I also think greater wisdom and utility in the way in which AA came to be. But it was a significant event in that period of time, and it's not ever talked about. If you go pick up 10 books in the library on the Great Depression or the 1930s or the New Deal, the only book that ever even gives kind of marginal attention to the reality of AA was Amity's book. And so now here we are in this fentanyl and heroin and opioid crisis. And of course, drug addiction has been a significant problem in the States for a long time. But a lot of people pointed out that cocaine was not killing people at the same rate. that opioids were, because it's a very different drug, and amphetamines have a different impact. The nature of opioids is much more addictive, much more brain and neurological damaging, and the stats speak for themselves. We just had over 100,000 people die. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
That's nasty.
Yeah.
Crack, which was largely prevalent in the 80s in more urban communities, was also very addictive, fatal, but it got a lot of attention, and it didn't ever put up those numbers. But if someone were to say, well, people ignored the crack epidemic because of racial bias, I would probably say I don't think we ignored it. You know, now we didn't solve it, didn't cure it, because at the time, some of the common sense measures were less readily available. And it is also true, Will, that 12-step programs were not thought of at that point for narcotics the way they were for alcohol. And now I think that portfolio of 12-step treatment has largely expanded. Betty Ford had a lot to do with that, and also just the needs in the society change.
Well, I just, you know, you said you were talking about the spontaneous order that arises out of a group of people, you know, one alcoholic helping another in some church basement, as it's, you know, usually parochially described. And I also know that, you know, when I look at Schellenberger, who I really admire, as you know, I think he's just a remarkable guy. He and I both start out our trips on the left, and he has come to be this real critic of the progressive movement and its impact on cities. I think his book is called San Francisco. And, you know, I just think the sort of arrest and compel model is problematic. And I, you know, we don't need to get into the complexity of that observation, but I will just say that the idea that you can make someone recover from a spiritual malady seems highly problematic. You know, this is the problem of addiction is fundamentally a spiritual one. And I suppose you could help drive someone to their spiritual bottom more quickly if you arrest them and throw them in prison. But I'm not sure that you're going to get them recovered in quite the way that, you know, an AA does. You don't get on a bus, drive around in circles, and then end up in an AA meeting, I would imagine, by accident. You go there because you want to change, and you're ready. You're open for it. So, anywho, I bring that up in part because Schellenberger has, I don't know if it's this article or in others, has mentioned that, you know, the drug markets in San Francisco, the addiction problem in our cities is so frustratingly powerful and omnipresent now that it's driving the sort of small time and now increasingly well-organized theft, burglary, robbery, carjackings. You're seeing more and more people, you know, as we did this past weekend, Saturday night, gosh, where's the story? We had 80 people enter a Walnut Creek, that's Contra Costa County, for those who aren't familiar with the joint. But, you know, so it's an upscale suburban community in Contra Costa County. 80 people rolled into a Nordstrom there, well-organized, like a flash mob, and just went through the place, just picked up. They parked their cars outside, on the street, all of them blocking traffic, ran inside, grabbed stuff, ran outside, threw it in their cars, and drove away. And I, you know, I'm intrigued by this. It happened in San Jose that same night. It happened in San Francisco at a Louis Vuitton store. Same idea, same modus operandi. And I'm just really intrigued that this is happening in these places. It might be linked to drugs. It you know, quite possibly is. One of the things that we know it's linked to is the decriminalization of crime and the rhetoric around defunding the cops. And just really quickly, let me put a footnote here. Kamala Harris's tweet about the outrage of the Rittenhouse verdict goes back to, I think, her first and fatal blunder on that case when she went out to go meet with the guy who cops shot, Jacob Blake. You might remember Jacob Blake. This is the whole event that sparked the Kenosha riots that drew in Rittenhouse. But this guy, police stop him while he is violating a domestic violence restraining order at his former girlfriend's place. The cops try to stop him. They try to talk to him. He starts wrestling with them in the street, fighting them. I mean, he's fighting three cops. And when they tell him to stop.
And you're not really supposed to do that.
I would say that it's not a good retirement program for you to start to fight with cops in the street. It's just seems like a dumb plan. And he's literally fighting. He's a big guy, and he's fighting with these three cops. One of them pulls a gun and tells him, stop, stop. He keeps walking away from them toward his car, opens the door, reaches in to grab what, you know, we don't know. Could be a gun, could be a knife. The cop shoots him in the back. Kamala Harris shows up at his bedside and declares him a hero, right? She has set up whoever saw that, whoever saw her canonization of this guy, her hymn of praise to him as a hero and his family for being so long-suffering and patient. She has set up another generation of young black men, young men in general, to go fight with cops as if that's somehow something that a law enforcement person ought to be engaged in doing. She's running for VP at this point. So, you know, this is how we get now to people, I would argue, in San Francisco, where you've got Chesa Boudin as your DA talking about how we really have to be softer and gentler and look at diversion programs. And we've got Prop 47, which says you can't really be arrested for stealing. It's a misdemeanor to steal up to $950 per violation.
Have you heard the new thing going on with that?
No, tell me.
A bunch of them are adding it up wrong.
Oh,
and,
is that right?
And they're like accidentally stealing like $1,100 thinking they get a free pass. And then they find out like they miscounted.
Ah, that's so sad for them.
No, but it's not because this is really funny.
That's what I'm saying. So, you know, I was talking to Richard.
Can you imagine me the cop who gets to like count the price tags?
Oh.
You're like, oh, you're over the limit. They're like, no, I'll put something back.
Yeah. I was talking to Rich Lowry about this offline. I hope I'm not revealing too much here. Rich doesn't listen to our podcast, do you, Rich? So he was asking me, like, why do you think this is happening? I said, because you've got these liberal DAs in these big cities and they have decriminalized crime. And it's a problem. I think the most interesting thing there, I talked to our Orange County DA, Todd Spitzer, who told me point blank, look, man, I'm not charging people for not wearing a mask or violating a vaccine mandate. I'm charging people who commit actual crimes. An unnamed person in the sheriff's department who spoke to me on the condition of anonymity said, same thing. We're not running around enforcing dumb laws. We're here to really crack down on violent crimes against people and their property. This is what policing is for in the end.
Although I gotta say, I have a little run-in with the cops myself this
talk
week.
Talk to me. This is coming back from Michigan, right?
Going into Michigan.
Tell me.
Now, what I don't know is if it counts as cops, because aren't they TSA technically in the airport? I mean, if they got a gun and a badge, they're sort of a cop.
That's a cop.
I flew from LaGuardia to Grand Rapids last Tuesday night, late at night. After a day of work in the New York office, I was landing in Grand Rapids so I could I had a number of appointments and meetings and interviews and work Wednesday. Then I was meeting you for Father Sirico's retirement dinner Wednesday night. And I have flown a lot of times since COVID. And you recall in the podcast a couple weeks ago, I mentioned that people need to just stop doing the whole thing, whatever. Mm-hmm. And meaning more like a whole lot of people together. At some point, the airline staff will break down in their resolve to be overly militant in the just utterly absurd mask mandates on planes.
Were you performing an act of civil disobedience?
Well,
I
was not, because even though I'm all for it, this was a small plane. When I'm on the bigger planes I fly on from LA to JFK, I have my own kind of whole pod area, and then I don't really wear the mask, and they don't really ever ask me to. And I'll have it on when you walk on the plane, you know, but then you're eating and you're working, and they just kind of leave you alone. I haven't really had any issues. But, you know, I was on a smaller plane. You have a guy next. Oh, no, I actually – it was one of those with one row on one side and two seats on the next. So it was a small plane. Mm-hmm. And I was by myself on that seat, but, again, I kept the mask on, and then I would take it down when I was drinking my water. I was working. And a couple of times it like slipped and they said, there were two times they said, Mr. Bonson, your mask. And I put it back up. No one got mad at me. No one said anything. I wasn't being problematic at all. It's not really my style. I got off the plane and there are three cops pulled me into a private room and sat me down. And they're like, we have a complaint. The airline called ahead. You weren't wearing a mask. I go, excuse me. I don't have any idea what you're talking about. And I was sort of laughing a little, and they said, look, this is, you know, it's a classic, he said, she said case. And I go, yeah, is it? Is that what that means? I think that usually applied
to another
in a really
situation.
Different crime altogether. And so I said, well, you know, this is good timing because I'm on Fox News in the morning and I have something to talk about. and I did. And
did
I went
you really?
I went on Varney's show and I talked about Delta's overzealousness and airline traffic is still down about 19-20% from pre-COVID levels, but it's up obviously huge. You know, they've recovered 80%, but considering no international travel and still such constricted business travel, it's pretty good. But now it's kind of flatlined at the same level. And I think the way they're acting on this passenger thing, but these cops actually were pretty nice, but they were more just, I think they were kind of shocked, like, what did we get caught in here for?
Yeah.
And I said, well, is there like a case number or whatever? He goes, yeah, can I just call you with that later? And I said, yeah, so am I free to go? I didn't know if I was going to, you know, get roughed up a little bit.
End up
or
in the
what.
Pokey, yeah.
And actually, now that I understand it's legal to get in fist fights with cops,
yeah,
that probably is what I should have considered as one of my options. But that thought never
entered
my mind.
Didn't seem like a good idea.
So then I was in my car service on my way to the hotel and the cop calls and I'm in the back seat, this poor driver listening. And I said, yes, officer. And I go, okay, so that's my case number. And I go, now, by the way, officer, what does this mean? He goes, to be honest, it doesn't really mean anything. I go, so what happens? I go, what do you do now? He goes, I just throw it away. I go, so why did you give me a case number? He goes, I don't know. You asked for it. and I said, and then what is Delta involved? He goes, well, you know, they're going to investigate her and they may reach out. And so it happens to be that I had a Delta flight booked to return to New York, but I ended up booking a flight to come out to California. So I wasn't going to use the back end. But I was curious if that flight would get canceled or if I'd get a notice.
You mean like you'd be on the no-fly list?
Yeah, or if they'd send me notice like you're not eligible to fly Delta for a month or something. Mm-hmm. They've been doing that, some other airlines, and nothing like that happened. I have a feeling in all seriousness that maybe – use of Google or the media the next day that maybe they did say like, probably don't want somebody talking on television about, you know, Delta. Maybe had nothing to do with it. All I know is I was not being a problem and this thing happened, which means you got to figure there's a lot of people out there who are being a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're asking people that, again, they are, I agree, they probably don't have a ton to do. But they are there to do like real law enforcement. There are drunken disorderlies at airports. There are, God forbid, even potential terrorist thing, or at least the need to prevent and make sure there's not. There's various activities, and then meanwhile they're sitting here dealing with me. I mean, it's just laughable. But the old me would have been upset. I wasn't upset. I was amused. But just hearing these guys, and I said, like, look, in 1996, I got pulled over. I got carjacked and a gun to my head for 45 minutes while I had to drive around people that were engaged in criminal activity and they were threatening to murder me. And when I finally got let go and I escaped and I called the police, they said, we don't have three cops that'll come into that area to help you. And now here we are 25 years later and there's three cops to greet me off of Delta Airlines at Grand Rapids Airport. Is this what it's come down to? But I'm pro-police. I'm not making fun of the men in blue, men in black. What is it? Men in blue.
Yeah, it's our boys in blue, yeah.
Yeah,
it's also the Dodgers.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is what you say about the fact that in 1996, you can't get a cop to respond to the fact that you've just been carjacked at gunpoint and now a mask mandate you can. This is exactly what Orange County DA Todd Spitzer is telling me when I talked to him today. You know, that in fact, this is a question of priorities and enforcement. And we are not going after that stuff. We're going after the stuff that matters. I could go on with San Francisco and the looting, the fact that tourists are now being warned apparently not to rent cars there because they can identify you as a, you know, car rental person and then go after you. So, hey, let's.
Now, are you in agreement with me that we got to get rid of the mask thing on airlines?
Yeah, but you know, one of our listeners. Let me find this here. So sorry, lost my place. Marshall McBride. You know, is responding.
Wait, did he say you could say the name?
Yes, he did.
Okay.
Yeah, Marshall wrote. A really good guy. Said, look, man, he would ask us to retract or rescind our suggestion that people stop wearing masks. You know, on planes, just to kind of make it an overwhelmed situation for the crew. And he says, you know, please, like, consider seriously. An airplane, whether you're on the ground or in flight, is not the place for an act of civil disobedience. People need to just obey the flight attendants and flight crew and raise issues or complaints after they've deplaned. And then he goes on to make, I think, a really good argument. As believers in property rights and capitalism, we know that an airliner is a private property of a corporation. The corporation has the right to enforce any rules it wants, whether mandated by government or not. We can petition the company to change its policy.
Well, say that last sentence again. The government has the right.
He says that we're believers in property rights and capitalism. We know that an airliner is the private property of a corporation and that that corporation has the right to enforce any rules it wants, whether mandated by government or not, on its property.
Yeah, but again, that part, I agree with everything he's saying. That part, though, it misses the point because I'm not debating I'm debating what ought to be, not what is. Mm-hmm. So it's just begging the question.
Well, he's saying if you have a problem with that, our job on this podcast is not to say, let's get an act of civil disobedience going on in the air. You were not doing that, of course.
No, I wasn't. But I do think that if a private company is arbitrarily doing something, let's say it wasn't a government mandate, and they're doing something stupid and counterproductive, and you make it so inconvenient for them to enforce it, then I think the company is likely to reverse their policy to something more rational and coherent. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, if it wasn't for a mandate, people could and would. See, the thing about if it's a mandate or not is the crux of the matter. Because if there wasn't a mandate and Delta said, we're keeping our mask mandate going, then people would go, well, good luck with that because I'll be flying American.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The point is, because it's an FAA mandate, no one in competition gets taken away.
Right.
So where is their flexibility in this if there's no flexibility in the FAA mandate? The flexibility is in the enforcement. And this is not controversial and it's not civil disobedience. This is the nature of American jurisprudence, the speed limit cops. Do we say the cop has to enforce a 56-mile-an-hour criminal?
No, we do not.
No. And so my point is that if you see a 2-year-old who's kind of struggling keeping their mask on, not every flight attendant is required to go, I will throw your ass off this plane. Okay, nobody believes that. No one believes this. So there's common sense bandwidth for enforcement. And I think that we got to get to a point where we utilize behavioral efforts to help the airlines along in a more coherent and rational enforcement of this nonsensical policy.
There were two guys flying on my plane into Orange County who were wearing matching masks that said, wearing it because I've been forced to. That was it. You've got to get rolling. I got to get rolling here. I'm going to cut a bunch of stories out, but I do want to get to one little fun item, and that is that the Staples Center in L.A., the house that Kobe built, is going to be renamed the Crypto.com Arena.
Finally.
It is the largest naming rights deal in history.
Since the Enron deal or the Pets.com deal. Do me a favor. Just run a list of the college football bowl games naming rights in 1999, and just tell me how many of them are still around.
Yeah, there's some wackadoodle ones there. That's a good point.
Stadium naming rights are the best contrary indicator in the history of my business.
You think so? As soon as you do that, you're slated for death?
The only thing that could be worse is getting on the cover of a magazine.
Yeah.
And fortunately for crypto, it hasn't gotten any media attention yet.
Well, what's interesting, I guess the name actually...
Those who didn't capture it, like Will.
The name...
I was just kidding.
The name switches after Christmas Day. And it's just so bizarre. And I thought it was a little on point. Crypto. A state that is driving and a city that is driving its economy into a grave, crypto. I'm sorry. I know there's a big difference there, but all I can think of is like, this, I think they'll end up calling it the crypt. In fact, who wants to go to the crypto.com? Whatever?
You know what I'm going to call it?
What are you going to call it? Staples.
Staples Center.
Yeah. David, we have so much
what
more
do
we
you call,
talk about.
What do you call the, well, first of all, I'm not even sure if it hasn't gone to a third name.
The Pond?
So isn't it Honda Center now, or is there a third one?
I think it's Honda Center still.
Honda Center?
Still the Honda Center,
I
Brian
still
says.
Call it the Pond.
A Pond, right.
I was, well.
The Arrowhead Pond. But I don't call it Arrowhead. I just call it the Pond. I don't call the Angel Stadium, even was the Disney whatever.
You call it the Big A?
Big A or just Angel Stadium. Yeah.
And you know what I call the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum? The Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum. Did you know that they sold naming rights to United Airlines?
Every once in a while, we'll hear TV announcers call it that, and it's like, wait, where's the game? Yeah. I love the fact that the Bruins call it today the mausoleum.
I'm going to go with, I think that the crypto.com thing, it will end up being a marker.
For?
The end of the company. Beginning of the end.
For that company.
Of a certain mania.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Like this is more industry-wide.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I am intrigued. Yeah. We could have a whole Capitol Records podcast on that one. Have you done a whole thing on crypto? Because I'd sure
not a whole episode to it, but I've talked about quite a bit.
All right. And you also did an appearance, just before we wrap up here, you did an appearance on Joan. I guess you recorded, but it's not out yet, right?
I think it comes out tomorrow. So by the time people are listening to it, it will be out.
I cannot wait. Two of my favorite people. All right. Well, that's all the time we have today. You can always find this podcast on the National Review website, but it'd be easier for you and better for us if you just subscribe. And of course, rate and review the show wherever you subscribe. That boosts our profile and helps others find us. And I've lost something that I ought to know by heart now at this point. But I'll ask people to just, you know, continue to send us great story ideas. I'm sorry if I didn't get to yours this week. Let us know what you think of the show. And I want to thank everybody, especially our friends at National Review, but not just them. There's Sarah Schutte, of course, and Rich Lowry and others. Jack Fowler, who helped create this show. And also our own in-house engineering team. That's Glenn Hall and Brian Tong, who's here with us right now. So please keep listening. Tell us what you think of the show. And what do we say? La revolución continúa en la semana próxima. We'll be right back.